Here with a first look at what it says in this morning's newspapers is Pádraig Lodge.
Concern over COVID tracing system is the front page headline in the Irish Examiner. Keenan Brennan reports that privacy concerns have been raised over the HSE's new COVID-19 tracker app after it emerged that GPS location services are a prerequisite for the app to function on a large percentage of phones. The report says location services must be enabled on Android phones, which represent around 39% of the Irish smartphone market. This means that all apps on the device which mine location data will be empowered to do so as long as the HSE app is running. The paper also tells us about another high-profile business closure on Patrick Street in Cork. Clark's Footwear is to cease trading, joining a growing list of retailers departing the street, including Debenhams, Monsoon, Oasis and Warehouse. According to the Irish News, Queen's University has chartered a jumbo jet to bring hundreds of students from China to Belfast. The university fears a loss of income from its international students would leave a hole in its budget running into millions of pounds. A spokesman for the university said additional flights may be arranged from other countries, depending on demand. The Irish Independent leads with figures from the Road Safety Authority showing that more than 37,000 people are on their fourth or subsequent learner driving permit. The RSA says it's difficult to say why so many are relying on a permit for so long, but some appear to have no intention of taking a test. Reporting on last night's personal statement in the Dáil by Agriculture Minister Barry Cowan, the paper notes that despite mounting pressure on him to do so, he still hasn't provided an explanation on how he managed to get to the age of 49 without acquiring a full licence. Education editor Catherine Donnelly reports that parents tempted by a foreign holiday may be putting their child's chances of going back to school at risk. Alan Mongey, president of the National Association of Principals and Deputy Principals, commented that heading off to Portugal or Spain will present significant challenges to schools accepting those students in September. The Irish Times tells us that Taoiseach Micheál Martin will travel to Northern Ireland tomorrow to meet First Minister Arlene Foster and Deputy First Minister Michelle O'Neill as the new government seeks to rejuvenate North-South relations. Mr Martin told the paper that he would not be pushing for a border poll, which he believes would be divisive, going on to state his preference for a consensus approach rooted in the Good Friday Agreement. The Irish Daily Mail's lead is a warning from Age Action that the majority of elderly people will be excluded from using the COVID-19 tracker as many don't own smartphones. The charity is pleading with the government to help the elderly to get access to the app. Homebuyers in the north are having to hand over deposits of over 20% due to the economic impact of coronavirus. That's the top story in the Belfast Telegraph. The Irish Daily Star reports that businesses in Limerick will not have to pay council fees for street tables and chairs placed outside their premises. Limerick City and County Council is to waive all fees due, saying the measure would enliven the city streets. Summer delayed with woeful weather forecast is the Irish Daily Mirror's headline over a report telling us that another grim day of weather is in store for the country. But finally, on a brighter note, we read in the Irish Sun about 26-year-old shop worker Sean Keeley from Dungiven in County Derry, who won £1 million on a £5 scratch card.
A stupid mistake, a grave error, the Minister for Agriculture and the Marine, Barry Cowan, told the Dáil he was profoundly sorry for drink driving on a provisional licence 4 years ago. A spokesperson for the Taoiseach said it was clear that Minister Cowan deeply regrets what happened and that Micheál Martin accepts that his remorse is genuine. Barry Cowan addressed the Dáil but didn't take any questions.
My decision in September 2016 to drive home after consuming any alcohol was a stupid mistake. It never happened before the 18th of September 2016, and it has never happened since. It is a mistake for which I am profoundly sorry. The emergence of this issue into the public domain has put an intense spotlight on me and on the shame, more importantly, the shame of drink driving. The criticism that I have attracted for such a serious lack and lapse of judgment is fully deserved. This grave error, my subsequent humiliation, will hopefully serve to highlight the terrible dangers and consequences of drink driving.
On Primetime, Susan Gray of Road Safety Group Park was asked by David McCullough if she was satisfied with the Minister's statement.
Did Minister Cowan answer the questions you wanted answered tonight?
Not one of them, David. We are so disappointed with him. He rang me this morning about 10:30. and I put the questions to him again. He assured me that he would answer as many as he could tonight during his statement.
For more, let's talk to our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham. Morning, Paul. What more did we learn last night, and are there still questions for Barry Cowan to answer?
Well, we certainly learned a lot about how Barry Cowan himself views the drink driving incident and subsequent ban. As you heard from that clip and your introduction, it was quite stark. He said it was a stupid mistake. He was profoundly sorry. It was a grave error. He spoke about the shame and he spoke about the criticism, something he said was fully deserved. He also gave some more information about other driving issues. We knew that there had been a speeding fine, and he also disclosed that there was an issue of failure to display a tax disc around 14 years ago. On the issue of the learner permit and stroke provisional licence, that was something where we got some detail, but not all of the questions which had been posed by opposition TDs had been answered. He contended that it was not uncommon to be driving on a provisional licence or learner permit for many years. He accepted that it wasn't best practice, that it should have been regularised, and it since has been. But we didn't get detail about, say, for example, whether or not he had worn L or N plates before and after the test, if he was driving a motor ways, if he'd been unaccompanied or not. So we got some information, but not all of what had been asked of him. And he concluded by saying that he had been talking with the Agriculture Commissioner, Phil Hogan. He'd been talking to his Northern Ireland counterpart. There was a desire to do his job and represent his constituents. And what we've learned from at least the view of Micheál Martin, the Taoiseach, and of course Fianna Fáil leader, he described it as a clear, abject apology. It was clear that Minister Cowan deeply regretted what had happened, and the Taoiseach accepts that his remorse is genuine.
What other reaction has there been?
Opposition parties have been giving their initial response. We'll have to wait to see what the party leaders say, but Sinn Féin sources were saying that the minister had clarified the situation, that he had thrown his hands up and said what he did was completely wrong and apologised, and the source said that the row was now a distraction from issues that need to be urgently dealt with, such as affordable housing. So taking that on its face value, that would seem to suggest that Sinn Féin is happy enough with what Minister Cowan said and wants to move on. But that wasn't the case when it came to the Social Democrats. They felt there were still lots of unanswered questions, and it does not draw a line under the controversy. Equally, the Rise TD Paul Murphy, who yesterday tried but failed to get Doyle Business changed so that Mr Cowan would answer questions on the matter, contended that Mr Cowan had failed to answer the questions about his driving on a learner permit, and he argued there were other questions which needed to be answered, such as did he drive unaccompanied, did he display L plates, did he ever pass a driving test. So for some on the opposition, they want to move on. For others, no, they want to have more questions answered.
Paul, stay with us. The Green Party leadership contest started last night with an online hustings via Zoom for those members in the South constituency. Ballot papers will be sent out to all members this week and must be returned by Wednesday, the 22nd of July. Party leader Eamon Ryan has been challenged by deputy leader Catherine Martin.
Catherine has huge skills for the job of leading the Green Party, and I do too. I think primarily is my experience. And that's a difficult one to sell, because maybe you say, God, your man's an alpha, he's been around for a long time. I have. But in that time, I've learned how the European councils work. I know how government works. I know how the Dáil works, how local councils works, how campaign works. And that experience is what I want to use for the next few years to help us make the next step.
It's important to get the balance right between, you know, holding on to expertise and experience and bringing fresh eyes and into, you know, and encouraging people to step up or know that they can step up or get a position in a party. Being a long time in a certain role doesn't necessarily mean you're the right person for that role always. And a new person might bring something different that is needed in any role.
And we'll hear more from Catherine Martin later in the programme. Paul, what sort of contest can we expect, and who's going to win?
Well, I think it's going to be a polite contest. Green Party members will get their ballot papers this week. They have to be returned by Wednesday, the 22nd of July, and the winner will be announced on the 23rd of July. As you heard there, each candidate, Eamon Ryan and Catherine Martin, were setting out their stall. What they weren't doing is pulling lumps out of each other. I mean, for example, Miss Martin paid tribute to Eamon Ryan about his leadership and how he'd taken the party from the electoral ashes, but she felt that she had qualities now which would be of more benefit to the party. So you had the sense that it was going to be a polite contest. They got down into the nitty-gritty of how the party operates, you know, questions like how will you ensure there are more young members in the party, what's your view on term limits for party leaders, that type of detail which will be of interest to Green Party members, not necessarily the wider public. I'm still of the view that that point that Eamon Ryan made about his experience in government at this particular time when the party has chosen to go back in again will weigh with members. And so a guess, a shot in the dark, my feeling would be is that if Eamon Ryan stays in this race, and there's no reason to believe he's not going to, that he's the most likely winner.
Paul, thank you. That's our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham.
As new minister with responsibility for the arts, the Greens' Catherine Martin is being urged to maintain current wage supports for individual artists until the sector can operate again at full capacity. In a report to the Arts Council, an expert advisory group called for an immediate $21.4 million survival fund to avert the collapse of arts enterprises and a further €30 million sustainability fund for 2021. Angela Dorgan is a member of the advisory group and chair of the National Campaign for the Arts, and we can talk to her now. Very good morning to you.
Good morning, Brian.
To look at this in economic and financial terms for a moment, Angela Dorgan, the arts, you argue, is facing a much deeper recession than the economy as a whole.
We do the EY report that came out alongside the report from the advisory committee that I sat on, had a stark reality that the art sector will contract by 42%. And that's compared to an 11% contraction in the overall economy. So they also point out that the art sector could take until 2025 to recover this crisis, and that there's a worry that some of the 1,500 to 1,900 jobs at risk in the arts might close and might go, and that the recovery may take between 2023 and 2025 to recover and restore the art sector.
So in terms of what you're looking for now from Catherine Martin, and we'll be talking to her later in the programme and can get a response perhaps to some of what you have to say, what does she need to be thinking about right now?
Well, the immediate you've already referred to is extending the PUP to artists and arts workers to use the $20 million to the Arts Council this year to sustain the arts organisations and the artists. And then further, we will need her to encourage the taxation laws to be looked at, both for VAT to be reduced for those in the events company that surround the art sector and in the art sector itself to be reduced for rates holidays and VAT holidays, maybe for those working in the sector, mm-hmm. and a further $30 million for the Arts Council for next year, because a lot of the arts organisations who provide the infrastructures for artists to make work and make a living will be under threat of closure, because the investment from the Arts Council is never anybody's 100% income.
Yes.
We make income from ticket sales and sponsorship. Those opportunities are now closed to us because we can't work at full capacity. We can't present events and festivals at full capacity.
But if your projection is that the sector won't really begin to recover until 2025, is that kind of level of state support going to be necessary, not just next year, but the year after that, and perhaps the year again beyond that?
No, the EY observation is that unless support is forthcoming, that's what could happen, so that it could take till 2025. So what we're saying is to offset those jobs and to allow us and the arts organisations, the arts sectors and the arts workers to be maintained and saved and held within the industry, that recovery will be much quicker. The EY report points to without support.
Yeah, the worst case scenario.
The bleakest worst case scenario. Exactly.
I understand. Just in terms of getting back to some kind of normality, I presume it's the case that as long as the current public health guidelines remain in place for social distancing and so forth, particularly performance venues, it's just not going to be viable for them to reopen.
It's not under the current laws. Venues, theatres can only work at 15% capacity. And if you're working on budgets, 15% tickets at the door won't cover the costs of your engineers, your lighting engineers, your artists and everybody else. So it won't be viable to go back to anywhere near normal.
But if you don't have audiences, how can you really create work?
Well, the artist can create work. Not all work is presented for performance. So this is really about those who make work for performance and where mm-hmm. the work that they've made can be commercialized through performance. A lot of those who work in the performance area will pivot and are pivoting and have pivoted to online presentation. And mm-hmm. as part of the 20 million from the Arts Council report has it will make an amount of money available to organisations and individuals to adapt to online presentation. But on top of that, I suppose it would be great to see the Minister raise the issue of fair pay for artists on those online channels.
Well, as I say, Angela, perhaps we'll be able to pick up some of that when we talk to her a little later on the programme. But for the moment, thank you. That was Angela Dorgan, Chair of the National Campaign for the Arts, at 24 minutes past seven.
Due to the impact of the COVID pandemic, 80% of the normal supply of blood donations is required as a result of the cancellation of many procedures and surgeries. Meanwhile, the Irish Blood Transfusion Service has seen a 13% drop in donations since the beginning of the year. Now, as the country gets back on its feet, it's expected hospitals will soon follow suit, and along with that, demand for blood is sure to rise, according to the Irish Blood Transfusion Service. Our reporter Eamon Ní Riada visited a blood clinic in Kerry to explore how the service has continued to provide during COVID-19 restrictions.
Well, I think it's a good thing to do. People need blood. You never know when your family or yourself will need blood yourselves. And I've done it almost 50 times.
A seasoned blood donor, Bobby Connell, once again visits the pop-up blood clinic in Castle Island.
It's a bit different this evening, obviously, with the social distancing. We haven't experienced that here in Castle Island before.
Until now, the significant drop in the number of people donating blood around the country has not caused concern. That's mainly because of the reduction in hospital procedures as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic.
I'm Sharon Cronin and I'm the clinical nurse manager here with the Limerick team. So we service all of North Kerry and North Tipperary, all of Limerick and all of Clare. In the very early stages there, in the middle of March, the demand from the hospitals dropped off considerably. I suppose they were in the height of trying to navigate their way at the time. And for about 2 weeks, we were kind of unsure where we were going and we cancelled a couple of clinics. But since then, since the beginning of April, we have been functioning and operating as normal.
Now, with efforts in hospitals to ramp up procedures on non-COVID-19 patients, the IBTS is pulling out all the stops to get as many donations as they can before demand starts to rise. With that comes some changes as to how they operate.
We scaled back the donors that we were working with, and we were only using regular donors, so people who had donated in the last 2 years. We do a lot of pre-screening with them on the phone before they come. When they arrive at the clinic, then they meet the civil defence and they ask them a number of those questions.
Will you donate today?
Yes.
Lovely. Will you answer a few questions for me?
I will.
In the last 2 weeks, have you had any fever, cough, sore throat, changed taste, smell, fatigue, nasal discharge, frequent sneezing, shortness of breath or difficulty breathing?
No.
Is there anyone at home that's unwell?
No.
In the last 14 days...
And then they have to fill out the health and lifestyle questionnaire, so they're asked those questions for a third time. And that's the aim of all of that, is to make the clinic environment as safe as possible for everyone who's participating and to maintain the safety of the unit of blood at all times.
They're small changes, but make all the difference to the confidence of the staff. Working at the Castle Island Clinic on the day was Marguerite Maher.
Now that, you know, I've kind of gotten used to things a bit more, I'm not nervous anymore. I was, I think, a little bit at the beginning, when everything was a little bit more uncertain. The newest things for us is the PPE, the masks, wearing the goggles all the time rather than just when there's a risk of splatter, and obviously the social distancing element to it as well. And the donors have all been very understanding of, you know, us kind of maybe taking a bit of time to learn the new processes and things like that.
For those who might be nervous about making an appointment in the current climate, Sharon Cronin has this note of reassurance.
If anyone is anyway unwell in the 28 days after donating, they're asked to contact the IBTS or the Irish Blood Transfusion Service and let us know. There is no evidence to date to suggest that COVID-19 can be transferred in a blood transfusion. But if somebody was in here tonight and they were unwell tomorrow and they rang us, then we would, depending on what their symptoms are and where they're at, we would withdraw that unit of blood. We wouldn't use it. We wouldn't take any chances.
For Angela O'Connor, the news that the IBTS can carry on working through the pandemic provides huge relief. She was left fighting for her life almost 20 years ago after a routine operation resulted in a three-day ordeal and a year-long recovery for the Carsevine woman.
To me, it was like going to the dentist, you know, that kind of way. Like, I went up to Dublin on my own. I was coming down the next day, you know. It wasn't meant to be a big deal, you know, that kind of way. I had stress incontinence. There was this new procedure called TDT, so it's local anaesthetic or whatever. And so they went in one side, which was fine. And when he went into the other side, he actually ruptured my iliac vein with the needle. So, you know, I was bleeding out the whole time. In the process, I got 20 units of blood. I was still getting blood, actually, a day or two afterwards. Basically, the way I look at it, it's the gift of life. I mean, only for it, I'd be dead. And there's no fancier way of saying it, or, you know, it's as simple as that, really, you know.
Angela O'Connor speaking to our reporter, Amy Nee Rieda. It's 7:29. Adam Maguire is here with the business news.
Thanks, Gavin. Global markets fell yesterday and overnight as traders digested a more pessimistic outlook from Europe and America. Yesterday, the European Commission poured cold water on hopes of a rapid rebound in the bloc, while a continued rise in new claims in the US has cast doubt on plans to ease COVID-19 restrictions in many areas. Online fast fashion retailer Boohoo has launched a review of its supply chain and said it would invest £10 million in eliminating malpractice in its factories. The Sunday Times reported allegations that its staff at a Leicester-based supplier were being paid £3.50 an hour and had not been offered protection from COVID-19. Retailers Next, ASOS, Amazon and Zalando have dropped Boohoo's products following the claims. German logistics company DHL plans to cut up to 2,200 jobs of workers based at Jaguar Land Rover factories in the UK, according to the United Trade Union. The job cuts comprise just under 40% of the entire DHL workforce on the contract. The union said DHL indicated that half the job cuts are due to a decline in car production and half are a result of anticipated efficiency savings. Finally, for now, the currencies, €1 buying you $1 US dollar and 12.7 cent and 89.8 pence sterling.
And at 25 to 8, a very good morning to Darren Frell. Darren.
Good morning, Brian. Well, the race for top four place in the Premier League is boiling up nicely. Chelsea up to third in the standings, 3-2 win against Crystal Palace, 2-0 up at one stage, but Palace got back into it and Chelsea holding on a bit in the end, but a big win for them. Leicester are fourth. They drew 1-1 with Arsenal. The Gunners led 1-0, but then they had Eddie Nketiah sent off. Jamie Vardy made the extra man count, went on to equalise in the 84th minute. For so long, Leicester have looked like they were going to take the automatic Champions League place, but now they're beginning to feel the pressure, and their manager is Brendan Rodgers.
Well, I think it's huge for us. You know, Arsenal, as you've seen, have been on a really, really good run, playing with big confidence. But we've been able to come here after a tough game at the weekend, come away, play well. Can't win the game, but we don't lose it, so it's really good for the spirit. And we'll now get ready and go into the game at the weekend. But I think it gives us great confidence again to continue with this mindset and just stay focused on the next game.
Now, Arsenal not happy at all with that sending off of Nketiah in the second half. Was only on the pitch a matter of moments after coming on as a sub. Mikel Arteta, the Arsenal manager, was confused by the referee's decision to check in firstly with VAR and then to walk to the sideline and check the monitor for himself.
What I'm saying is that if we review incidents of that type, we review them all. And it has to be something equal for everybody because it changes the game completely.
Watford moved 4 points clear of the relegation zone. They had a 2-1 win against Norwich City. Norwich will be relegated if they lose to West Ham at the weekend. In the Championship, Brentford overcame Charlton 2-1 to maintain their promotion push. Fulham beat their promotion rivals Nottingham Forest 1-0. Blackburn overcame Cardiff 3-2. And there was draws between Luton and Cardiff and Reading and Huddersfield. Now, an independent inquiry will investigate allegations of physical and emotional abuse met by a number of British gymnasts. Francesca Fox, who competed at London 2012, is one of those who has come forward. She spoke on ITV News last night.
I wasn't tall and I wasn't skinny. I was short and quite curvy. I already got told I was fat at age 10. And this went on until I retired when I was 20. And I was weighed 2 to 3 times daily, sometimes more. And because of this, it was an obsession. And I could weigh myself 6 to 10 times a day. because I got made to feel like I had to be a certain way. Rather than me being just me, I was told constantly that I was fat, that I looked like a hippo, that I couldn't jump because I was too big.
Yeah, just reading through some of the detail of the allegations this morning, some absolutely frightening stuff in there, and it follows on from the abuse scandal in the US. I think it's probably given the British athletes, you know, something to, a voice maybe to speak up and to follow up on that as well. The Women's British Open will go ahead as planned at Royal Troon in late August, but without spectators. And finally, Fernando Alonso is back again. Well, looks set to return to F1 with Renault next year. The two-time world champion will turn 39 later next month. I'll be back with more sport after the news at 8:30.
Brazil's president Jair Bolsonaro has tested positive for coronavirus. Over 1.6 million people are reported to have had positive tests in Brazil, and over 65,000 people are known to have died from COVID-19 infection. Mr. Bolsonaro has repeatedly played down risks of what he called the little flu or the sniffles. He has opposed lockdowns, which he says hurt the economy. The executive director of the World Health Organization, Dr. Mike Ryan, wished President Bolsonaro a speedy and full recovery from the disease, adding, "I think the message to us all is we are vulnerable to the virus." Tim Vickery is a reporter based in Rio de Janeiro. I spoke to him earlier and put it to him that the surprise was not that Brazil's president had caught the virus, but that it had taken so long.
I think that's a fair comment. He's been merrily wandering around the country, provoking agglomerations. He's been shaking hands, pressing the flesh, and he's done much of it without a mask. It's the fourth time that he's been tested, and I think it's a fair comment. The surprise is that it's taken him so long to contract the virus.
His survival, politically and literally, hinges on the outcome of his illness. If he survives, will it strengthen his position that the coronavirus is just a little flu?
Well, at the moment, he's saying that he feels absolutely fine. He said that he didn't feel too clever on Monday. He had a high fever on Monday and some aches and pains. But speaking to the press on Tuesday, he declared himself absolutely fine, in full conditions to do his job. He said he wanted to go for a walk, but the doctors didn't allow him. This is being seen, I think, internationally as a huge defeat for Bolsonaro, the man who's been the world's leading denier of the importance of coronavirus finally contracting the disease. But he certainly doesn't seem to be seeing it that way. In fact, so far, the fact that he's feeling fine would seem in his mind to reinforce the view that this is only a little flu. And he's using some very strange metaphors. He's saying that the virus is a little bit like rain. It rains on, it's going to rain on some people and not on others. He seems to have ignored the fact that one person infects another, and many people who he has been in contact with since Friday are frantically having themselves tested now. He said that his message to young people was, don't worry too much, because if you get it, it's not going to be particularly severe. The problem is not the young person getting it, it's who the young person then infects. You've got to remember here that on March the 22nd, Bolsonaro predicted that the death toll from coronavirus in Brazil would not exceed 800. We're already approaching 67,000. So that particular argument he has lost, and he will be judged by the scale of that failure. But for the moment, he really can't change course. He's gone too far down one particular road to change course. He's left him and his government very little room for manoeuvre on this issue, and there's no sign of the death toll slowing down. In fact, the specialists seem to be believing now that the peak actually won't come until August.
What's it like where you are in Rio?
Well, Rio is the second most affected city in the country after São Paulo. Of those nearly 67,000 deaths, more than 10,000 have come from Rio. I think you have to see Brazil a little bit as a kind of United States of South America. The state is divided into 27 states, a huge country, and it's the local authorities, the state governors and city mayors, who have the authority to declare lockdown lockdowns or social distancing and closed commerce. Bolsonaro has always been against this. So there's been a very confused message all along, with different levels of government often wanting different things. Two health ministers have gone. One was sacked because he was quite effectively arguing the need for social distancing. His replacement didn't stay too long before leaving, also disagreeing with the president. And this fundamental lack of clarity from different levels of government has undermined greatly the efforts to bring into effect effective social distancing. Just over the last few days in Rio, there's been a gradual opening up with possibly disastrous consequences, because huge agglomerations in the bars of some of the richest areas of Rio, and it's I think to be feared that in a couple of weeks, this lack of social distancing will be reflected in the death toll.
You've been living in Brazil for a very long time now, and you've seen a lot of change during that time. How would you characterize the health of your home now?
Well, Brazil is extremely polarized. Everything is polarized and politicized. And I think what has happened over the last 3.5 months, the country's response to the coronavirus, will go down in the annals of human incompetence. They had a number of advantages. The principal advantage that they had over, say, Italy or Spain was time. They saw what was happening there. They had time to prepare. And Brazil does have a health service based on the British National Health Service. It's rudimentary, it's underfunded, but it is there. Unlike, say, the United States, the death toll in Brazil would be far, far higher without that health system. But despite these advantages, and despite the advantage of time, and despite the advantage of considerable experience in dealing with pandemics, Brazil has performed very, very poorly. Neighbouring Paraguay, 20 deaths. Uruguay, 28 deaths. These are much, much smaller countries. Argentina, slightly bigger, 1,500 deaths. All of these countries have performed much, much better than Brazil has. And the fact that it's still being politicized, the use of masks is being politicized. President Bolsonaro recently vetoed an obligation on people to wear masks in public spaces such as churches and shops. It's very, very disturbingly polarized and very worrying that the coronavirus is nowhere near being brought under control.
That's Tim Vickery in Rio de Janeiro.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel will appear before MEPs in the European Parliament today. She'll set out her country's priorities as it takes on the European presidency. A global pandemic and a recession of historic proportions, not to mention Brexit, are among the issues that the Union will have to grapple with during Germany's six-month presidency. Together for Europe's recovery is the German motto. We can talk to our Europe editor, Tony Connolly. Tony, first of all, this appearance before the European Parliament today, its significance, an opportunity presumably for Angela Merkel to set out her stall.
That's right. I mean, this is a set piece at the beginning of every presidency that a country takes over. Countries spend 2 years preparing for presidencies, preparing all the meetings that they have to host. Remember, Ireland had the presidency in 2013, so there were numerous meetings in Ireland, ministerial but also smaller official level meetings, and it's a great opportunity for a country to showcase itself and its talents and so on. All of that work for Germany was simply swept aside by the pandemic, because a lot of those meetings will not be happening in Germany. And it is quite striking that Angela Merkel is able to travel to Brussels today for this address to the parliament, but she will be setting out her priorities for the presidency. And of course, they will be dominated by the pandemic, the big recovery fund that EU leaders are supposed to sign off or at least get agreement on at the end of next week, and what that recovery fund should look like, what it will be made up of, what conditionality will be attached to the monies that countries get. but also in a lot of other big ticket issues that the German presidency hopes to address, such as migration. Germany, of course, took on a million refugees and asylum seekers back in 2015. The EU's migration policy is still very fragmented. The Green Deal, how to transform Europe's economy by 2050 into a carbon-neutral economy. A lot of big challenges, but of course, these are going to be really made a lot more difficult by the fact that meetings can't take place face-to-face for the time being, apart from sporadically.
Specifically in relation to the pandemic and particularly the economic fallout from it, what's the situation in relation to support for what Germany is proposing, this recovery fund? There's opposition from what are described as the Frugal Four, a number of countries that Germany normally is a leading part of. That's not the case this time.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be a lot of speculation and attention paid to what Angela Merkel says today in the European Parliament about the recovery fund. She made quite a tactical switch, perhaps a strategic switch, a few weeks back when she sided with the French President Emmanuel Macron and agreed that the pandemic presented a huge, unprecedented and extraordinary challenge to Europe, and that it would have to take a much more bold step towards effectively mutualizing debt, which has been a sacred taboo for Germany for years. But she now seems to have shifted her position towards the French position on this, in the teeth of opposition from, as you say, the Frugal Four, Denmark, Sweden, Austria and the Netherlands. But of course, if you don't have Germany on your side, it's harder for those countries to stay the course and make the case. But the big, I suppose, question is, how much of that money will be in loans, the 750 billion euro fund? How much will be in grants? What will the allocation key be? I mean, in other words, how will the money be distributed to different countries, different regions? What conditionality will be attached to it? Will it require big-time reforms in countries that receive this money and so on? These are very, very political questions, and that's going to be one of the big challenges for the German presidency.
Very good. Tony Connolly, for the moment, thank you very much indeed for that.
Yesterday, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg and COO Sheryl Sandberg held a video conference with representatives of the month-long advertisers' boycott of the social media platform. They're concerned about the site's handling of hateful content and misinformation, but they said they saw no commitment to change from Facebook at yesterday's meeting. To get an idea of what impact the campaign is having in Ireland, I earlier spoke to Suzanne McGilligott, who's CEO of digital advertising body IAB Ireland. Its members include advertisers, ad agencies and publishers like Facebook. So I started by asking her what share of the Irish digital ad market Facebook currently had.
Everybody would consider Facebook and Google to have, you know, approximately 70% between them of the total ad spend. And, you know, they would be one of the major players in social media advertising and obviously video as well. So that's not unique to Ireland. It's the pattern globally.
So in terms of the recent boycott that started at the start of this month, very much US focused and focused on US firms and multinationals. But from what you've seen and the conversations that you may have had, has any of that transferred through to the Irish market spend as well?
One or two advertisers have contacted us saying they were looking into this with their advisors and with their agencies. Some advertisers have come out and said they're taking that stance, but we haven't had actually a lot of contact about it at the moment. That's not to say it's not happening in the background. We assess advertising spend at year end, so really it's very early at this stage to be able to call it.
Is there a way to try and gauge the mood amongst advertisers? And would they tend to take stances on platforms like this in terms of the ethical or moral issue as opposed to simply what's the most effective way to advertise their brand?
Well, I think increasingly that's becoming very important. I think it's becoming very important to all of us, even as consumers, in terms of looking at brands and looking at their priorities and their environmental ethics and their labour ethics. I think similarly for brands, it is becoming increasingly important, and they're playing a more active role in understanding where their advertising spend is going. Of course, we know that COVID has absolutely impacted adversely on the market. So looking to year end, their estimates that 20% 50% of digital ad spend, like over 130 million, may actually be down this year. So, you know, it is now more important than ever for advertisers to look at the ethics and to look at where their advertising is going.
You mentioned the impact COVID is having. There has been the suggestion companies would be reining in their ad spend anyway as a result of the pandemic. So is it maybe handy for them to pass that off as a good deed in terms of their cutting back their spend on Facebook?
In terms of our brand members, I think they think strategically, and I think they're making decisions that are more informed over long-term strategy than taking short-term views like that. And so I suppose what we find is that, you know, really those that have joined us as members want to have, you know, a high level of digital knowledge, want to be able to work well with their agencies and with publishers. And yes, they want to ensure that any decisions they're making, that they will be able to stand over them and that they understand them.
Facebook earns billions from advertising around the world because it works as a platform. So, I mean, can companies, be they SMEs or multinationals, can they really resist that opportunity regardless of what's being shared on the platform? Or at the end of the day, do they simply have to go back to Facebook?
You know, everybody as a user as well, going forward, the choice in terms of values and ethical choices are becoming more important. And I think our members, and that's all I can speak about our brand members, that is a genuine, that is a really genuine response that they have and a need that they have. And it's not something, it's not a question of jumping on the bandwagon. It's something that, you know, is very important. And while companies, you know, profit is also very important, I think they can actually be mutually beneficial. And I think they will increasingly be.
Suzanne McGallagher, CEO of IAB Ireland there.
Time at 4 minutes to eight for a look at what the weather has in prospect for us today. Matthew Martin is at Metairn. Good morning, Matthew.
Thanks, Brian, and good morning here from Metairn. Well, we have been in an unsettled weather regime for many weeks now, with temperatures below normal and rainfall amounts well above average. And there will be further rain in many areas today, but the weather looks set to gradually settle down over the next few days, with drier weather expected, albeit with some showers in places. It's a dry morning in parts of the north and northeast of the country, but mostly cloudy and damp elsewhere, with areas of mist and drizzle, and with some scattered outbreaks of rain. A more persistent spell of rain will move eastwards across the country during this afternoon and evening, giving heavy falls in places, but northern Ulster does look set to remain mostly dry. Highest temperatures for today ranging from 14 to 17 degrees, and winds will be mostly light. We'll turn dry then across much of Connacht and Ulster tonight, but remaining damp with patchy rain and drizzle elsewhere. Then tomorrow Thursday will begin rather cloudy in the east and south with a few patches of rain and drizzle, but brighter weather to the west and north will extend across most areas during tomorrow afternoon. However, there is the risk of a few showers developing also. Highest temperatures for tomorrow of 15 to 19 degrees. Looking then ahead to Friday, it looks set to be a bright day with sunny spells and just a few passing showers. It will feel rather fresh though in a moderate northwest breeze with highest temperatures by then of 14 to 18 degrees. And then looking further ahead to the weekend, a good deal of dry weather overall, but with varying amounts of cloud. Saturday will bring a mix of cloud and bright spells with highest temperatures of 16 to 20 degrees, whilst on Sunday there's a chance of patchy rain in some western and northern areas. But it will be generally dry elsewhere with some warm sunny spells and highest temperatures of 17 to 21 degrees. But then to recap for today, staying mostly cloudy with further outbreaks of rain spreading eastwards, but parts of North Ulster will remain dry. That's your forecast. Thanks for listening and have a good morning.
It's 8 o'clock. Good morning again on Wednesday the 8th of July. This is Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 with Brian Dobson and Gavin Jennings. The news is read by Mary Calpin.
The Taoiseach Micheál Martin has described Agriculture Minister Barry Cowan's statement to the Dáil last night about his ban for drink driving as an abject apology. A spokesperson said it was clear that Minister Cowan deeply regrets what happened and the Taoiseach accepts that his remorse is genuine. However, some opposition politicians argue that Minister Cowan still has questions to answer about the incident which occurred in 2016. Our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham.
In his Dáil statement, Minister Barry Cowan accepted he made a stupid, stupid mistake, which had never happened before or since, and he was profoundly sorry. He said what he termed his grave error should highlight the consequences of drink driving, and he said the criticism of him was fully deserved. Mr. Cowan contended that it was not uncommon to drive on a learner permit for years, but accepted it was bad practice and that he should have regularised his position sooner. A spokesperson for the Taoiseach said it was clear that Minister Cowan deeply regrets what happened, and Mr. Martin accepts this remorse is genuine. A Sinn Féin source said Mr. Cowan had accepted what he did was completely wrong and apologised, and the matter now was a distraction from urgent issues like affordable housing. However, sources from the Social Democrats as well as Rise TD Paul Murphy said Minister Cowan had yet to answer all relevant questions about the controversy.
Garda sergeants and inspectors say the easing of the COVID-19 restrictions has made policing the emergency regulations more difficult and caused confusion among frontline officers. A survey by the association representing middle-ranking Gardaí has also found that the majority felt Garda management did not prioritise their welfare, particularly in relation to testing and protective equipment. The AGSI General Secretary, Antoinette Cunningham, says the Department of Justice and Garda management must provide operational guidelines and appropriate training along with legislative changes. Our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds.
More than 1,100 Garda sergeants and inspectors took part in this survey, and while they found the public's interaction and response to COVID-19 policing to be positive, they are critical of Garda management. 94% said Gardaí, like paramedics, should have had access to priority testing, while almost two-thirds said facilities should have been provided for them to self-isolate following a spit or cough attack or contact with a suspected case. Two-thirds of middle-ranking Gardaí also felt the protective equipment was inadequate. 87% welcomed the use of spit hoods as additional protection and want them retained after the pandemic. 94% said policing had become more difficult as the COVID-19 restrictions have been eased. The AGSI General Secretary, Antoinette Cunningham, says not only has the guidance and training on how to police the regulations been inadequate, but that confusion has also been a factor in border policing and still reigns as regards pub and restaurant inspections.
The latest figures from the Department of Health show that over 862,000 people have downloaded the new COVID tracker app launched yesterday. The app from the HSE aims to reduce the time it takes to find close contacts of people with the coronavirus. The acting chief medical officer, Dr. Ronan Glynn, has said it would have a significant impact in slowing the spread of the virus. The World Health Organization has for the first time acknowledged that COVID-19 might be spread through tiny particles that linger in the air. It was responding to an open letter from more than 200 scientists who urged the WHO to update its guidance. The UN agency has previously attributed the spread of the disease primarily to small droplets expelled from the nose or mouth of infected people that fall onto surfaces. It's now preparing a scientific brief to address the emerging evidence on transmission and plans to release further guidance in the coming days. Human rights and equality must be built into Ireland's recovery following COVID-19. That's according to the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission, which has published its annual report. The Commission says care for older people and people without the capacity to live independently needs to be addressed in public policy. Our social affairs and religion correspondent, Alva Keneally.
COVID-19 and the state's response to it has highlighted the existing inequalities in society, according to the IHREC. In its 2019 report, the Commission says the same groups who experience disadvantage or discrimination relative to the rest of the population have been hardest hit by the pandemic. It says the vulnerability of people in congregated institutional settings points to the need to address the role of institutionalisation in public policy. The Commission also says that COVID-19 has shone a light on what is classed as essential work in the economy and society, which it says is often neither well paid or secure. It points out that this type of work is frequently undertaken by migrant workers, and the right to decent work will be an ongoing focus of the Commission.
The time is 6 minutes past eight.
RTE Radio 1 Weather, sponsored by SuperValu. Our online shopping delivers value straight to your front door. It's got to be SuperValu.
A largely dry start across the north and northeast of the country today with some hazy sunshine possible. It will be cloudy and misty in most other areas with scattered outbreaks of rain and drizzle. By afternoon, heavier and more persistent rain will move in from the Atlantic, spreading eastwards across the country to affect many areas. Highest temperatures 14 to 17 degrees.
Porrick Lodge is here with it says in the papers.
The Irish Independent leads with figures from the Road Safety Authority showing that more than 37,000 people are on their fourth or subsequent learner driving permit. The RSA says it's difficult to say why so many are relying on a permit for so long, but some appear to have no intention of taking a test. Reporting on last night's personal statement in the Dáil by Agriculture Minister Barry Cowan, the paper notes that despite mounting pressure on him to do so, he still hasn't provided an explanation for how he managed to get to the age of 49 without securing a full licence. In her Dáil sketch in the Irish Times, Miriam Lord observes that the new Minister for Agriculture can't be accused of not getting stuck in immediately. Barry Cowan is barely a wet week in his job and already he's up to his oxters in manure. Back in the Independent, John Downing on the Green Party leadership contest informs us that party insiders say Eamon Ryan has a considerable advantage over his challenger Catherine Martin, given the sizeable backing party members gave to entering government. There's a report from Catherine Fegan that a crack team from the US investigating the disappearance of Annie McCarrick now believe that she did not attend Johnny Fox's pub in the Dublin Mountains. New York-based lawyer Michael Griffith, who's part of the team, said their own investigations have established that the sighting of Miss McCarrick in the pub was a case of mistaken identity. According to the Irish News, Queen's University has chartered a jumbo jet to bring hundreds of students from China to Belfast. The university fears a loss of income from its international students would leave a hole in its budget running into millions of pounds. A spokesman for the university said additional flights may be arranged from other countries, depending on demand. Owen English in the Irish Examiner reports that beach parties in East Cork are putting an environmentally sensitive coastal landscape at risk. Broken beer bottles, cigarette butts, disposable barbecues, tents and chairs are among the items being abandoned on beaches in Ballycotton Bay, which supports several species of wintering water birds. An Irish language slot on the Late Late Toy Show is among the goals for an ambitious Irish language plan for which the former Sinn Féin MEP Leonie Rida has been hired to oversee. And the announcement by the Labour Party leader Alan Kelly of his new front bench leaves the editorial writer in the Examiner unimpressed. Essentially like pub football on a bleary Sunday morning, anyone who turned up got a game. The Irish Times tells us that Taoiseach Micheál Martin will travel to Northern Ireland tomorrow to meet First Minister Arlene Foster and Deputy First Minister Michelle O'Neill as the new government seeks to rejuvenate North-South relations. Mr Martin told the paper that he wouldn't be pushing for a border poll, which he believes would be divisive, going on to state his preference for a consensus approach rooted in the Good Friday Agreement. The Herald covers a claim made in the High Court yesterday that a proposed €500 million wastewater treatment plant at Clonshock receives planning approval without any meaningful assessment of what comes out at the end of the pipe. A number of local residents are objecting to the development. Homebuyers in the north are having to hand over deposits of over 20% due to the economic impact of coronavirus. That's the top story in the Belfast Telegraph. Some were delayed with woeful weather forecast, is the Irish Daily Mirror's headline, over a report telling us that another grim day of weather is in store for the country, while the Irish Sun covers a warning that parents who bring their children on summer holidays abroad are jeopardising the reopening of schools. In the Irish Daily Mail, there's a stunning photo taken by Clodagh Blake of a puffin with a mouth full of fish on the Salty Islands in County Wexford. And "I'd horse a big feed" is the caption on a photo from Leakslip in the Irish Daily Star. The Salmon Leap Inn has converted horse boxes into stylish-looking private boots for outdoor eating. One diner commented that it was the best solution to social distancing that he's seen yet.
Well, less than 2 weeks into its term in office, the new government has already given us a Dáil ministerial apology and is providing the unusual political spectacle of a party leadership contest. The Greens, entering government for only the second time in their history, will also vote in the next few weeks on whether Transport Minister Eamon Ryan should continue to lead the party or be replaced by the current deputy leader and cabinet colleague Catherine Martin. Both took part, as you may have heard earlier, in an online hustings last evening for party members in the Ireland South Euro constituency. We're joined now on the line by Catherine Martin, Minister for Media, Tourism, Arts, Culture, Sport and the Gaeltacht. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning.
It's quite a list of responsibilities, and we'll try to talk about some of them in just a couple of minutes. But first, that apology last evening in the Dáil from your cabinet colleague, Barry Cowan. Abject is the way that Taoiseach characterised it. Has Mr Cowan dealt with this matter now satisfactorily?
Well, it was a serious mistake, and I think he has both recognised and hopefully learned from it. He suffered the punishment at the time, and this week that the negative coverage that he and humiliation coverage, as he described it himself, is rightly there. I think he's shown remorse, and while clearly it was a huge mistake, he called himself a stupid mistake. I would say it was a dangerous mistake because lives are put at risk if one drinks and drives, and the clear message is that you never ever do that. But and given the circumstances of his contrite apology, I would accept that he has both recognised and learned from it.
Right, and just one other point on this: road safety campaigners, some of them saying he still hasn't adequately explained why, at the age of 48, he was still driving on a provisional licence. Do they deserve an explanation?
I think that is the one issue that wasn't addressed last night. And I think he may have to, even reach out to them and explain that himself.
Okay, let's talk about your leadership bid. Why is it time for change at the top in the Green Party?
Well, the leadership election itself arises under our party's constitution, and it is a reminder of the vital role that democracy plays in our party. And we saw that last night in our hustings. We saw it during our special convention, the Programme for Government. I think this is less about a challenge and more about the healthy conversation, a conversation about the present and, more importantly, the future direction of a very different party to where we were in 2011 when Eamon was elected leader and I was elected deputy leader. We've a much larger membership. Indeed, we've had an explosion of increased membership numbers. And I think it's healthy to have that conversation now about the future direction of the party.
And what would the Green Party be under a Catherine Martin leadership? For example, if you've been leader, would there have been a different ministerial lineup in the current government from the point of view of the Greens?
I guess as a female politician and someone who set up the caucus and I set up our own green group in the Green Party, Manoglasa, I would also always seek to promote women in our party. But having said that, all Green Party ministers who are there are good for the job, and I respect the decision there. That was the prerogative of Eamon as leader. But I do feel that wherever we have women who have proven that they are ready and very able, then we should always seek to promote, because young girls cannot aim to be what they cannot see, and we should always be seeking to do that, to promote women.
So particularly in the appointment of four male junior ministers from the Green side, was that a missed opportunity?
Well, again, in relation to the male ministers, I congratulate them, and they're all able for the job. But I think they're it was a missed opportunity to promote women, and from our side, it was also a missed opportunity to unite the party as well. That nobody that voted no or advocated no to programme government was promoted to ministerial position, and I think that was a missed opportunity tonight. And we are a party that respect and cherish debate and challenge, and having those voices inside and within government at a ministerial table would have been welcome, I think.
Mm. Would you go as far as your colleague, Councillor Lorna Brogue from Cork, who talked about, and I quote her, an ingrained type of misogyny in the Green Party?
I know Lorna well, and she's a much treasured elected rep of our party. I think we have to be seen to do more as a party. We talk the talk in relation to promoting diversity and inclusivity, but if we're not acting on it, I think that's regrettable, and that's something I would like to see change.
Okay. Well, I say, let's talk about some of your responsibilities. We're not going to be able to get to them all. I mean, just about that, have you actually got a manageable portfolio there in terms of the range and spread of duties and responsibilities?
Well, I think they're all very connected. Our cultural and sporting life and our rich national language are all of what defines us as Irish and unique in the world, and that in turn contributes to our enduring appeal to international tourists and visitors. What they all have in common as well is I realise the challenge in these areas is huge. and crisis level. But I'm hitting the ground running. Last week I met with the Tourism Industry Task Force. This week I'll meet with the Arts Council and Sports Ireland later this week. I'll be meeting with Fáilte Ireland and Tourism Ireland next week. And Minister of State Dara Cleary and I also intend to visit the Gaeltacht in the coming weeks. So I'm hitting the ground running, but the main thing is I am fully aware of the crisis in these areas. Will be listening and doing my best to address that.
Specifically, let's talk about tourism. It's a major employer, as we're all fully aware. I mean, I think something in excess of 250,000 jobs, and a lot of them in areas where there aren't other employment opportunities, as many as one in five, for example, up and down the Western Seaboard. Now, the tourism industry have a number of specific asks to help them get through this crisis, cutting the VAT rate to 5%, a €1.5 billion package of not loans, but grants, actually grant aid at support to help them maintain liquidity. What's going to be your response to those specific requests?
To rebuild this strategically important sector, which is a huge part, firstly to recognise it's a huge part of Ireland's National Recovery Plan. And I'm on the Cabinet Committee on Economic Recovery. We've been working on that on the July stimulus package. As I said, I met with that Tourism Recovery Task Force within my first 2 days of Minister last week, and I'll be working alongside the bodies and the business who will be central to rebuilding our national and international visitor numbers. It's clear, Brian, you know, that the COVID-19 has decimated both international and domestic tourism. And we need to look at ideas like the extension of the temporary wage subsidies scheme to April, and including seasonal staff, which Minister McGrath has indicated. I'll be bringing that to the table. I am on that cabinet subcommittee. I am their voice fighting for them.
And so that would give people working in the industry some financial security through to next spring.
Yes, that's what I'm going to bring to the table and advocate for, and that's what the industry is looking for too.
Right, and again, if you look at the arts area facing a very deep and serious crisis, we were hearing earlier from the National Campaign for the Arts about the extent of what they face, perhaps a recession much deeper in economic terms than even the wider economy. Again, they've got specific asks in terms of funding and supports. What's going to be your response to that?
And again, you know, we need the arts like never before. The arts, as we know, are therapeutic. They're empowering. They're at the heart of who we are. They define us as a people. And they need to be supported, and they need to be resurrected from COVID and given new life. So I'm listening to the artists. I'm fully aware of their concerns. Again, you know, in the arts sector, the passion of work is one that moves in and out. And the arts and culture sector is heavily dependent on the pandemic unemployment scheme and on that temporary wage subsidy scheme. And the Arts Council Expert Advisory Group report proposed, you know, that government maintain current wage supports for individual artists and art workers and organisations, and that is something that I'll be looking at. And this month I will set up, as recommended by the Arts Council, I will set up a task force with the stakeholders. But all the recommendations there and supports that are being suggested, we are in discussions at the moment, and all those matters.
I suppose in all of these areas there is urgency, because really so many of these enterprises, whatever area we're talking about here, are facing really a life or death struggle at this stage.
They are indeed, and that's why, you know, I'm setting up that task force, you know, immediately, you know, in my role as minister, and I am meeting the Arts Council this week, and I just want the all artists to know that I'm fully aware of the huge challenge of the crisis is there. I'm listening, and I'm going to do my best to I'm taking on board the recommendations, and I'm doing my best to fight for my MAT cabinet. I'm working on the July stimulus package. I'm on the Economic Recovery Committee at cabinet, and they have a voice at that table.
And that's not to talk about sport, which we could, about your responsibilities in relation to the Gaeltacht. I mean, also, Dara Cleary in both those areas will have duties as a junior minister. He also sits at cabinet, and I suppose people might be wondering, if you're the president of the GAA and you want to talk about something with government, who's the go-to minister? Is it you or is it Dara Cleary? Who should they be picking up the phone to?
Well, we'll be be working very closely together, but Dara's remit is sports and the Gaeltacht, but I suppose I'm the senior minister and I will be keeping an eye and overseeing on that, and Dara and I will work very closely together. We're both at the cabinet table and we, through the programme for government negotiations as deputy leaders of our parties, we have a very good working relationship and I think we'll be working together in everything. As I said, okay. In relation to the Gaeltacht, we will travel to the Gaeltacht together in relation to key issues in sport. We will work together on that, and I think that type of close working relationship will be good for all those sectors.
Minister Catherine Martin, we appreciate your time this morning. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Garda sergeants and inspectors say that policing emergency rules brought in to help slow and stop the spread of coronavirus has become more difficult and confusing as restrictions are changed and relaxed. A survey of over 1,000 middle-ranking Gardaí also found that the majority felt Garda management didn't prioritise their welfare, particularly in relation to testing and protective equipment. One more death and a further 24 positive cases of COVID-19 were reported yesterday. Antoinette Cunningham is General Secretary of the Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors. Antoinette Cunningham, good morning. Thanks for taking our call today.
Good morning, Gavin.
What are Gardaí confused about?
I think the confusion reigns according as the phases unwind, whether it's actually liquor licensing laws or health regulations are to be enforced at this point in time. And I think the last weekend was perfectly clear in relation to that. We do have the unwinding of the phases, the opening of restaurants, serving intoxicating liquor, and I suppose when we're asked to carry out checks, is it liquor licensing laws we're checking or is it the health regulations we're checking? And that is becoming confusing for our members, and I think clearer guidance is needed around it.
Do Gardaí have the power to close a pub if they're found to be breaching COVID rules?
Well, the Gardaí have the power to enforce the liquor licensing laws if they're found to be in breach of the COVID laws. But we don't have the power to close a pub there and then. What we have to do is send a call to the DPP where breaches are detected. That's the guidance we've been issued with. But I suppose over the last weekend, there would have been confusion amongst frontline members whether it was the health guidelines in relation to checking on social distancing, PPE of staff in restaurants, social distancing that we're checking, or is it the liquor licensing laws that we're checking?
And do you know now?
Well, we don't really have the clear guidance, and that's the point that AGSI are making. If legislation is going to be introduced by government, then clear guidance is needed. And if I can take you back to the start of this policing this pandemic, Gavin, you'll remember that when we started to police this pandemic in March of this year, but the regulations were not signed by the Minister for Health until the middle of April, and then we had to wait for guidance to be issued. And guidance when it comes to the enforcement of legislation or regulations is not something that can be vague or unambiguous. It must be clear-cut, and members must be crystal clear on what it is that they have to do.
What were Gardaí most concerned about in this survey?
I think Gardaí were first of all, very, very pleased with the levels of cooperation they received from members of the public. And the 92% of sergeants and inspectors had high positive interactions with the public during the emergency legislation, and that should be recognised. The positive response that we got from the public as well was overwhelming, with 97% of our members saying that every time we went out there, it was a positive interaction in the main that we had. I suppose the real concern was around the priority testing for members and the lack of support perceived from Garda management in areas like the provision of PPE equipment very early in the pandemic, policing the pandemic, the lack of priority testing for members, totally and utterly unacceptable to our membership.
What do you mean by lack of priority testing?
If a member of an Garda Síochána Conna was deliberately spat into the face by somebody, that they would have to wait a number of days for a test and a further number of days for a result. And we did see other institutions, such as the Fire Brigade, being able to get priority testing delivered and a result within a 5 or 7 hour period. And we would have liked if our own Garda management had moved to a situation where that could have occurred for our membership.
In a statement, on Garda Síochána say that at all times, on Garda Síochána has operated in line with public health advice from the central, CMO, the Chief Medical Officer, the National Public Health Emergency Team, the Health Service Executive, and the Garda Chief Medical Officer. They go on to say the welfare of Gardaí was at the heart of a wide range of internal measures introduced by An Garda Síochána from the very start of the pandemic. One of those protective measures, Antoinette Cunningham, was the use of spit hoods, which cover the face of someone who is being detained by Gardaí to stop them being spat at or biting officers. Now, This is due to be reviewed in September. It's already been used 78 times, and it can be used on teenagers, I gather, at least 3 times so far on teenagers. What do Gardaí feel about the use of spit hoods? Do they want them to be continue to be used?
Yeah, well, I suppose the first thing I should say about the anti-spit guard, Gavin, is that it is for the prevention of a potential assault. And spitting is a real and tangible threat. And we know that in many cases, in fact, there were 93 incidents of spitting or coughing deliberately at Gardaí between April and June of this year. And in some cases, that was spitting of blood, and in many cases, spitting of saliva and blood. So the thing that I want to say about anti-spit guards is they are only used in exceptional cases and where a real threat exists. There is a policy around their guidance, and only qualified members can place an anti-spit guard on a member of the public. But the interesting thing about them, as an additional layer of protective equipment, the majority of the members in AGSI felt that, in fact, 87% of them welcomed the introduction of the anti-spit guard, and 86% said it should be retained as an additional layer of PPE. But can I say, in relation to the anti-spit guard, we are fully conscious of the policy and guidance that have issued by Garda management in relation to their use, and they're only used where the threat of spitting or assault exists.
Do you accept the criticism of the policing authority, who say there's been very poor record keeping in their use?
Well, I mean, the record keeping is a matter for Garda management. Whatever records are required to be kept, they have to be kept by the members that are operational on the ground. So we're fully au fait with what records we have to keep. But whether Garda management are lacking in that area, that's a matter for them.
Antoine Cunningham, General Secretary of the Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. 29 minutes past 8.
Pharmaceutical firm Gilead Sciences is to create 140 jobs in Ireland as part of a €7 million investment that will also see it establish a new base in Dublin. The company already has 370 full-time employees at its Cork facilities, which includes a manufacturing plant in Carrigtwohill. The new roles are in areas including clinical development, finance and IT. Residential property asking prices fell by an average of 3.3% in the year to June, according to the latest DAF.ie housing market report. The data also shows a 0.2% rise in prices sought for rents nationwide in the year to June 2020. An online fast fashion retailer, Boohoo, has launched a review of its supply chain and said it would invest £10 million in eliminating malpractice in factories. That comes after the Sunday Times reported allegations that staff at a supplier in Leicester in England were being paid just £3.50 an hour and had not been offered protection from COVID-19. Retailers Next, ASOS, Amazon and Zalando have dropped Boohoo's products following the claims. Finally, the currencies, €1 buys you 89.9 pence sterling and $1 and 12.9 cent.
Darren Fahill, good morning again.
Good morning, Gavin. Chelsea are up to third in the Premier League table, but it wasn't all plain sailing for them last night in a 3-2 win over Crystal Palace. 2-0 up, but then they let Palace back into it. Got a bit of a scare and looked to be holding on in the end, but a big win, according to their manager, Frank Lampard.
They're big because of the position we're in. We know it's tight in and around us, and it's nice mentally to be third for maybe a short period, but that's what it is. I think the game could have been more comfortable for us tonight. Then we could have lost those 3 points and probably got one at the end. So maybe at this crucial period, it's nice to dwell on the 3 points, but my job as well is to look at ways that we can get better, and we still can. There was some good and bad from us. I think game management, we weren't great. There were moments in the game where we should take this thing out of it and have more control. And be clinical as well on our counter-attacks and our opportunities in the second half. But I must also lean on the fact that, you know, Kepa makes a great fingertip save at the end. Kurt Zouma makes a great tackle. Sometimes you work hard for your luck over the course of a season. That ball hits the post and bounces out. A lot of those have bounced the other way for us as well. So I will hold on to that, and we move forward to the weekend.
Yeah, that race for a top four place really hotting up. Leicester, who were in pole position for third place for so long, they're now fourth. 1-1 draw with Arsenal last night. The Gunners led 1-0, but then they had Eddie Nketiah sent off. Jamie Vardy made the extra man count with an equaliser in the 84th minute. But the Arsenal manager, Mikel Arteta, very unhappy. He thought Jamie Vardy should have been sent off in the first half. Not happy with that decision at all, but Vardy would go on and score that equalising goal. Watford moved 4 points clear of the relegation zone. 2-1 win against Norwich City. Norwich will be relegated if they lose to West Ham at the weekend. It's looked that way for quite a long time, hasn't it? Now in gymnastics, some very serious developments in Britain. An independent inquiry will investigate allegations of physical and emotional emotional abuse made by a number of British gymnasts. We heard from one of those gymnasts earlier in the show, but some frightening detail coming through in light of these allegations. The story carried on ITV News last night, and one 8-year-old described how she was tied to vertical bars and bullied by her coaches to hang on at the age of just 7. British Gymnastics has announced it's conducting an independent review into allegations. Yesterday, Leinster winger Barry Daly announced his retirement from rugby. He's just 27 and will now take on a Masters at Boston College in America. Now, he certainly made the most of his 4-year career in professional rugby. You could say he was a bit of a late bloomer, plucked from the All-Ireland League to fulfil a childhood dream. He would become a top try scorer in the Pro 14 and be called into the Irish training squad. A real Cinderella story, but without the fairy tale ending.
I suppose I always felt like I'd maybe slipped through the cracks a bit, not getting a contract after, you know, my time in the underage system, and kind of made my peace with it, and I was kind of happy out working away where I was working and training and playing with my mates in the AIL. And, you know, Noel McNamara was the coach in UCD. I was playing for him. I was playing well, and I'd gotten picked up by the Irish Sevens. They were training me like I hadn't ever been trained before, and Leinster just came calling. They were looking for a winger. It was right place, right time.
Top try scorer in the Pro 14 in 2018, called up and trained with the Irish squad that year too. But then what happened?
I was excited for everything for the season to come, and fortunate that it was the first 10 minutes of the first game. I ended up tearing the cartilage in my left knee, and, you know, a 6-month recovery time. And even with all the work that we put in, the knee just wasn't quite right, and I was kind of struggling with it. I did manage to fit in a few games at the end of that season, despite it. My last game of the season ended up being against Ulster, where I ended up breaking my collarbone. Kind of led me into the start of last season. That sort of same niggly knee injury had kind of been at me, and the knee went the exact same way it had done before. So, you know, by the time I was back, there was the coronavirus pandemic sweeping the globe. So that was basically season over for me.
Was it a tough decision to call it a day?
It's never an easy decision, but once I got that knee operation at the start of, you know, the season, I kind of knew that it might be tough for me to get to where I want to get to. Ellen McCabe, player development officer in with the players' union, wouldn't have been any better in terms of helping me and telling me the options that are out there. And she put me onto this Boston College scholarship idea. I luckily got it. You know, the decision was kind of almost made for me.
Just finally, Barry, you packed a lot into those 4 seasons with Leinster. What will be your takeaway from the whole experience?
My takeaway is just how lucky I feel to have played for the club that I've supported since I was a little kid, and how lucky I feel to have learned from the people I've learned from over the past 4 years and play with some of the guys I've played with. And can't thank everyone enough, everyone that's helped me to get to this point. I feel really grateful.
Yeah, what a fascinating story. It highlights the uncertainty around professional sport, really, and maybe a couple of life lessons in there too. Never give up on your dream and always have a plan B in place just in case. So thanks to Barry for sharing the story. Good luck with the studies as well. More sport on the RTÉ Sport website, including a very interesting story on GAA clubs. And the question has been asked, who is willing to pick up the phone and call Croke Park to report out-of-season inter-county training? Very interesting piece. Check that out online. That's all your sport for now.
Fraud emails and text messages trying to trick people to share personal details increased during the COVID-19 crisis. That's according to Gardaí, who are warning cyber criminals are now targeting staycationers looking to buy camper vans, boats and caravans online. Our reporter Cian McCormack has a story. Cian, first, an email you received sparked your interest in all of this. What happened?
Well, Brian, I received a random email. It claimed I had missed the delivery of a parcel at my home. The email looked official. It had a DPD type logo on it, and it looked for my personal details. I found it all very strange because I'd been at home working all day. No one came to the door and I wasn't expecting a delivery. So on closer inspection, I looked at the email address and it looked really fishy. So I contacted DPD, which is Ireland's largest courier company. It confirmed the email was a fake. It said there had been a spate of these types of emails and was warning about them on their website. I talked to its chief information officer, Colin Kennedy.
what we've seen, at least for every communication and every variation of this email, that they use the exact same parcel and tracking number in every single email and ends with 8988. And they're just asking the consumer to come onto a website and to update the delivery address or instead to pay more money to get something delivered. Since COVID, there's been a tremendous increase in the online shopping. A lot of us have spent a lot more time online. With that growth, we've also witnessed an increase in fraudulent activity. And we've advised consumers at all time to engage with the Gardaí where they've seen this happening.
Cian, DPD is not the only company affected by this.
Yeah, that's correct, Brian. An Post has been targeted just like DPD and other companies too. Here's the head of communications at An Post, Anna McHugh.
Emails and text messages about deliveries looking for additional charges in order to make a delivery. Also another one around your TV license, maybe saying you've won a prize.
You're monitoring different scams and you're trying to hit them before they snowball into anything.
Yeah, we have a company, a brand protection service that monitors all of the online activity with our brand round the clock. And when they come across any of these scam emails or texts, they immediately take them down.
The Revenue Commissioners has been targeted many times too, and it often issues advisories reminding people about these types of scams. Here's Leanne O'Kelly from the Revenue Commissioners.
Revenue issues these reminders because of the ongoing circulation of fraudulent emails and text messages that purport to come from Revenue, and often they can be offering a refund of tax or requesting a payment for tax owing. These emails and text messages do not come from Revenue. They're random contacts from fraudsters who are trying to trick people into providing personal information. So it's really important that we issue these reminders and let taxpayers know that we never send emails or even text messages requiring the provisional of personal information, whether that be via a link, a pop-up window or a reply email.
Cian, what are the Gardaí saying about all this?
On Garda Síoch, Anna, it's calling for the general public to be vigilant. It says the pandemic has brought an increase in this type of activity. Here's Detective Chief Superintendent Patrick Lorden of the Garda National Economic Crime Bureau.
We're seeing a dramatic increase in this type of activity, Cian, especially since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. I suppose the message we really need to give out is that whether it's a text message or an email, no delivery company, no financial institution or Revenue or anybody else or an Garda Síochána will ask for your bank details or your PIN numbers to be supplied either by text or by email. They will not ask for those details.
Some of these scams are quite sophisticated and they're coming from what appear to be banks.
Yes, Cian, we had a scam a couple of weeks ago where very, very effective text messages were going to everybody, both bank customers and non-bank customers. But some of the bank customers fell for the scam in that the scam said your card had been compromised at a store or online and you were required to cut up your bank card and post it to an address. However, if you wanted to retain the same PIN number, you were to send the PIN number back by way of a text message to the bank. It looked really well, looked really professional, and quite a substantial amount of people did cut up their card, did send back the card to an address, which was a private address, I must add, which should have raised a flag with a lot of people. But then all of a sudden, the criminal was in possession of your bank card, which he was able to pin back together because it was only cut in two halves. And he was also in possession of your security number on the back of it. And he was in possession of your PIN number. But we were quite proactive with the banks involved, and we carried out some searches of the addresses where people were asked to send the cards back to. And it seems to have almost wiped it out and disrupted that method of committing these crimes very, very quickly.
Well, the people behind these scams change them as quickly as they invent them. And the latest scam is targeting potential staycationers. It involves cloned and fake websites. Again, here's the Detective Chief Superintendent.
The criminal gangs that are behind these scams are very organised, and they always are ahead of the curve. So, for example, at the moment, what we're seeing is quite a substantial amount of people looking to buy a new camper van, a new caravan, or a new small pleasure boat. Obviously, a lot of people plan to holiday in Ireland this year. And we have seen websites set up, bogus websites, cloned websites, and the criminal gangs behind them are asking you to send them a deposit for your new camper van or your new boat. And lo and behold, you never see the product and your money is gone.
And are you aware of people who've had that unfortunate experience?
Yes, we are. We are. The same criminal gang that we have targeted for quite a substantial period of time now. Historically, they were selling maybe classic cars or selling tractors. And now they're moving on to the items that are more in demand, I suppose, from the public. And people are a little bit, I suppose, careless in that they will send money if the deal is good. They will send money online, only to find out 2 weeks later the product doesn't arrive. And I would urge people to please deal with reputable businesses. Consider this. If the person said, I'm at the back end of a car park, will you just drop me down 2,000 euros and I'll supply you with the car or the camper van in a week's time? Would you do it? You wouldn't. But for some reason, when people are online, they trust the computer in front of them, and they shouldn't do that.
Detective Chief Superintendent Patrick Lorden of the Garda National Economic Crime Bureau there. The advice is clear from Gardaí: stop and think before you pay money over online.
A 300,000 euro conservation project is hoping to breathe new life into an overlooked corner of St. Stephen's Green in the centre of Dublin. Finishing touches are being put to the W.B. Yeats Memorial in the park. The memorial was unveiled to some fanfare back in 1967, but it's gone rather unloved in recent years. Our reporter Philip Bromwell has taken a look.
It is indeed fitting that we should honour the contribution of William Butler Yeats to the making of the Ireland that we live in.
Almost 53 years ago, the then Taoiseach Jack Lynch unveiled an abstract bronze statue by the celebrated sculptor Henry Moore before a sizeable crowd in St. Stephen's Green. Recent history hasn't been so kind to the knife-edge sculpture or to the W.B. Yeats Memorial as a whole. For several years, this area of the park has been overlooked and underappreciated.
The whole plaza here was overgrown. The sculpture was very much hidden, so you couldn't really see that there was even a Henry Moore in this part of the park. A lot of people I spoke to never knew it was here.
That's artist Jason Ellis. He's applying a wax coat to the sculpture as conservation works here come to an end.
It's not every day you get a chance to work on a Henry Moore.
No, you're absolutely right, no. I mean, there are three Henry Moores in the whole of Ireland in public collections. So the Hugh Lane have one, Trinity College has one, and this one here. And he's one of the 20th century greats in terms of modernism. He would have been a hero of mine as an art student. So 30, 40 years on, I get the chance to work on one of his key pieces. I think Knife Edge is what he called this piece. It's known as the Yeats Memorial here, but his title for it was Knife Edge. And I think it's one of his best works. So I think we're very lucky to have it here.
The pavements, steps and terraces surrounding the sculpture have also been restored as part of the €300,000 works. Audrey Farrell is a conservation architect with the OPW.
This is a hidden space within St. Stephen's Green, a very Victorian garden, but this has a very 20th century landscape, hard landscaping, which allows a different use of the space. The amphitheatre is ideal for performances, but a little bit over time became a bit forgotten about, and as the vegetation grew up in the area, perhaps got a little bit darker and underused.
St. Stephen's Green was one of the favourite haunts of W.B. Yeats, and while Henry Moore's abstract sculpture may divide opinion, those who have worked on this project believe it deserves to be seen. Here's Jason Ellis again.
When I first came up here, when it was totally enclosed, you couldn't see from ground level what was here. It just looked like an overgrown mound. And only the drinkers knew that it was a little hideaway place. And it looked very different. Since the work has been done, it's transformed, really. And it can be seen now from, virtually sort of 50 metres away. And like I say, people never knew it was here before. So I think it's going to get I'm hoping there'll be some sort of renaissance or some sort of fresh looking at the piece. You know, people might say, "Oh, I never knew it was there," and hopefully it'll get the attention it deserves. You know,
as he wrote, "True brother of a company that sang to sweeten Ireland's wrong, ballad and story, ran and song."
Former Taoiseach Jack Lynch reading from To Ireland in the Coming Times by W.B. Yeats back in 1967 at the opening of the Memorial Park to the poet in St. Stephen's Green. It's well worth a visit, by the way, for your staycation, if that's what you're having this summer here at home. That report from Philip Bromwell.
With even more rain on the way today, it's unlikely that a night spent at the beach would be much crack at the moment, but better weather has brought many revellers to the coast in recent weeks for beach parties. And the volunteers who clean up afterwards are warning that such parties are putting an environmentally sensitive coastal landscape at risk. Pronchi Sotuma is founder of Clean Coast Ballinamona in County Cork. Pronchi Sotuma, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
And welcome to Morning Ireland. Tell us what happened over the weekend in County Cork.
Well, I suppose this weekend you had a grouping of slightly older teenagers, maybe early 20s, gathering in a special protection area in Ardna Hinch Beach in East Cork. And I suppose it's nothing new for us, and it's nothing new for the area, but I suppose they party, they bring in a lot of stuff, they bring in new camping gear, chairs, have fires, lots of alcohol, and they really probably most of the time only carry themselves out of it and can, I suppose, to dispose of tents, they might burn them or not carry their empties out or anything like that. So look, it's a regular occurrence. I'm not saying that's an okay thing to do. I suppose we're just used to it at this stage, cleaning up after young people.
And when you were cleaning up on Sunday, you found some of the people still there who helped you out cleaning up, is that right?
We did, in fairness. They were the three that we kind of happened upon who were still there, I suppose, a little bit bleary-eyed, were, I suppose, not expecting us to be arriving down to do a beach clean. And look, the purpose of the beach clean is to go down and pull in marine litter and get out and, you know, get families out and connect with the sea and you know, all the wonderful mental health benefits that brings. But I suppose when... And, you know, we could have 40 or 50 people at a beach clean. And I suppose in the current times, we're restricted to, you know, small numbers.
Yes.
And when you have the small numbers who are picking up, I suppose, a concentration of beer bottles and, you know, dangerously, you know, broken glass. Because, you know, if you're flinging a beer bottle at distance and it's hitting a stone or a rock, I mean, it's going to break. So I would have had my 3.5, almost 4-year-old, let's say, with me. And you know, when I was talking with one of the kids in particular, I just said, look, I've got my young kid here with me. This is broken glass. And, you know, it's not a safe place. And I says, not to mention that it's a special protection area. But look, you're trying to talk with them and ask them to spread the word amongst their friends that, you know, it's not the dumb thing. Because I suppose I'm a school teacher. I'm home school community liaison in a school in Middleton. And the kids that I deal with every day are great. I see model behaviour every day when we're in school. And look, this is just a minority and it's grabbing the headlines. I mean, there's so many other good stories out there, you know. Like we're going to be planting 7,000 trees this year, you know, with broadleaf and apple trees for communities with the, you know, with sponsorship from Cove, Yall and the Health Services Credit Unions. So, I mean, like, these are the good stories that aren't getting the headlines. It's just the behaviour of a minority.
Okay.
That's kind of, I suppose, grabbing the headlines.
Pronchis, thanks for speaking to us. That's Pronchis Sotuma, founder of Clean Coast Ballinamona in County Cork. It's 2 minutes to 9.